From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Weekends with Alan Miller on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone, to the second part of the show. It was fascinating with Dr. Ellie David and Nullius in verba. Be skeptical. It's up to us together. Absolutely, indeed. One of the other pieces today in the Telegraph was by Camilla Tominey, who's talking a lot about the health impacts. And we've seen that, as Professor Carol Sikora and others have said, these lockdowns and the COVID-only NHS has led to all sorts of damaging impacts, particularly on cancer and across the board. And when we consider what has now become clear, what may have been saved, people may have been saved through lockdowns, there's a general recognition they were absolutely terrible, and we have to sort of make sure never again. Now, in the fog of war, as Dr. Eli David said, a lot of this stuff, the truth became the first casualty. And my next guest has written quite extensively about war, about militarism, about interest, about some of the things that have been happening in the Middle East, in Europe and elsewhere. She's now an academic at the University of Leicester and recently had a book on this subject and has been very critical about the situation in Russia and the Ukraine, but also about the policies around COVID. Welcome, Dr. Tara McCormack. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Alan.
So this is an issue that has split many people who were against lockdowns, and I think it's probably equally to say that people have very varied views about this in Britain. That, you know, just to contextualize it, Well, why don't we kick off by saying, you know, you just tell us a bit about your work, because you've written quite a bit already, and how you've got to, you know, this. And then I'll ask you a bit about your thoughts about lockdowns and how it's similar to perhaps or different to the discussions around what's going on with Ukraine and Russia.
Well, my most recent work, and I think we might want to chat about that in particular a bit later on, is on Britain's war powers. That is to say, who in the British Constitution has the legitimacy and authority to declare war? Now, of course, what we know is that countries very rarely declare war anymore. So this is a more general discussion then about who should have the authority. In the British Constitution, it is basically the government, in fact, really the Prime Minister, who has that authority. And then over the course of the noughties, particularly post-Iraq, there was a big discussion that grew up about the extent to which that is a legitimate power. And there are arguments that Parliament should make decisions. So that's one of my interests. That's my last book was on that topic, and particularly thinking around questions of intervention, for example.
Yeah. So the book, just so everyone knows, and I've posted it, is called Britain's War Powers, The Fall and Rise of Executive Authority, which is 2019.
Yeah.
And I wonder that to what extent, because if we look back in the last three decades, we've, just to before we get into talking both about COVID and parliamentary suspension and many of those things, we've seen that Britain, as part of coalitions and or sometimes just Britain and America, has actually had interventions in a number of places, including in Europe, across Libya, Iraq and elsewhere. And I suppose the question is, firstly, how do you see the relation? Because Ellie Davis just talked about, you know, it was like a war footing in Israel. Israel is obviously a military nation. It was like a war footing, the COVID presentation to the citizens and to the public. How much do you think that analogy is true for Britain as well?
Well, I think actually, if we're talking about COVID, I think very true for Britain as well. I mean, I'm sure you've discussed this with the previous speaker, the rolling state of emergency that was enacted across Europe was very similar. You know, we had Johnson, as we know, telling us that the country was in the greatest danger since World War II. and all these kind of insane, I would argue, preposterous comparisons. So actually, whether we're talking about Britain or even countries like Switzerland, we had an incredibly, we had similar responses that sought to draw parallels with conflict and establish a state of emergency. So I'd say actually very similar in Britain to Israel, although of course we know that Britain ultimately didn't go down the path of the Green Pass.
I was always keeping an eye on Israel because it seemed like they were one step ahead of where everywhere else what was happening. The move to impose mandates for vaccines and COVID passes and everything were all there. And as we've just seen with the EU, this European pass is being promoted alongside the WHO and others. I suppose my question is, the thing that really was really very, very concerning as well was how little public scrutiny and debate was had, but in terms of Parliament and in terms of MPs being whipped quite quickly. Now, there's that sense of it's an emergency, hurry up, we're at a crisis. It seemed like, although the things have been happening for a long time, the last couple of decades and the lead up to 2014, and what happened both in Georgia and the Crimea, the Maidan, Western intervention there. But it seemed that it was almost like as we stopped the vaccine mandates, all this then kicked off again around the Ukraine. I mean, some people think it was choreographed, but I know it's a concern of yours, the level of lack of debate and discussion. Do you want to talk a bit about that and how you see it?
Definitely. I mean, I'd say there are very strong parallels with COVID. As with COVID, let's take the media first. There has been absolutely no discussion about what I would say key questions, means, ends, consequences. You know, James Cleverly, our foreign secretary, echoes, and this is across Europe again, in the States, Australia, echoes. You hear these statements again and again. You know, our support for Ukraine is not time limited. We will do whatever it takes. But no one has asked us, first and foremost. And the media has been incredible in terms of preserving what I would call a consensus, borrowing from Toby Green and Thomas Fatsy's book on the COVID consensus, a war consensus. They have not asked a single word. Whatever we find out, the British government has pledged to send long-range missiles. We know they've said fighter jets aren't off the table. This year, we will have spent, over the last 2 years, £4.6 billion pounds on Ukraine. A lot of that we don't know on what. We know that special forces are there. You know, we also know last April that Naftali Bennett, the Israeli former Israeli Prime Minister, organized negotiations between between Russia and Ukraine, a Freudian slip there, between Russia and Ukraine. And he has given incredible 5-hour interview. I have no idea how he did that, which is available on YouTube. And he argues, and I remember watching it at the time, it was reported in the Israeli media that Bennett was trying to organize these negotiations. And there was a big drama because he even flew on the Sabbath, you know, and the Israeli press was saying, should he be doing that? And he argues in this interview that basically the Boris Johnson and America ultimately decided the negotiations would not continue. Now, to me, on the face of it, that is something you would think the British media would at least want to ask questions about. You know, this is the former Israeli PM. It's not just me or some random person. So the media has been utterly incredible. Not a ripple. Absolutely not a question to break apart the war consensus. And what we find, what we see instead, is that the media, if you look at the BBC, it's very, very clear what the media is. They focus very selectively maybe on certain battles, or we have batty, ridiculous articles most memorably about 4 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, a little bit longer, there was a ridiculous, clearly MOD propaganda piece on the BBC saying that the Russian reservists were now fighting with shovels. You know, you think, well, what's going on? So Russia is running out of ammunition, soldiers, tanks, fighting with shovels, but simultaneously such a threat that they're about to march on Warsaw. I mean, so I think that exactly as with COVID, the media has been absolutely derelict in its duty, which is to ask fundamental questions about, again, I'm not trying to make this a three-word slogan, but I think it's really important, means, ends and consequences. And the media present this very much to us as a kind of spectacle, you know, almost treat just as when Britain intervened in Kosovo or Libya, almost here we are, here are our boys doing good, end of story. But I think one of the real issues that we need to have much more of a public discussion about is about consequences. Russia is a nuclear threat.
If we look at that, there was a much discussion. So many of us who challenged lockdown said that, you know, there needs to be a cost-benefit analysis. We need to do things rationally. Sounds like your argument is a similar one almost, like, you know, what? Just talk rationally about this whole thing, not just... it's been some time in the making. I remember Kate Adie in her jacket in Iraq version one. I remember the discussion about a New World Order with George Bush Sr., and in beds where PR releases were given to those in the press, and they were given them and they were fed these ideas. They're often very much in keeping with the military outlook. And the idea of a Robert Capper or a Hemingway behind lines, finding out things. Now, obviously, there were some people like Vice and others, some broadcasters did some very interesting things in the Middle East and elsewhere. They did go to places. It was a bit sometimes gonzo at the start, but some of it was actually really professional later on. So I wonder how much of this has become a thing that in the absence of a discussion with the public about what, as you say, means and ends and what our role is, that this becomes a very kind of technical kind of, this is happening here, that's happening there, this is good, this is bad, yay, boo. Yeah, I suppose I just want to float it above, and then you can come back on the whole thing. But there's a question of someone has invaded another nation. A nation has invaded another nation. So how do you deal with that question in the context of all that's led up to it like that?
Well, the thing that I want to argue for first and foremost is our own, is a democratic debate within Britain about our foreign policy. You know, now we might have a different opinion about what Britain's response should be, but that is a different issue. The first point I want to make, and the most important thing, I think, is that there is no debate. And I think it is exactly with COVID, you know, there is no alternative. Nothing is being discussed either in terms of our role in the war, which I would argue is a proxy war, in terms of potential consequences, you know, what do people support? We don't know. Do people support going to war with Russia? I mean, I'd kind of hazard a guess not. But the point is, we're not having any kind of discussion, full stop. And that, to me, is what I want to get across. And that's what my biggest concern, the fact that there is no discussion, full stop. You know, and so then there's...
Go on.
Yeah, then there's a discussion about what do we think our role should be, which is obviously a discussion to be had, but that is a different discussion. But we're not having that at all.
So I was talking to a university lecturer, and she was saying to me how she spoke to her students, and they were talking about Ukraine. And she said, well, are you willing for us to shut the schools, the colleges, and all go to war and be conscripted? And I think it took them aback, a bit of shock, and they were aghast. But the idea that, I mean, there is a question about war. There are examples historically, like miners and cotton mill workers sent supplies independently to people that were challenging against slavery, the abolitionists and others in America. So there are examples where you can not necessarily just go and fight, but you can send support, right? It's not like you got, there can be solidarity and there's money that's sent and everything. But there, it seems like it is a distant thing. But just if you can, before the break, what do you mean by a proxy war?
Well, I would argue that this is a war that essentially is being waged, particularly by America, also the UK, which is, the hope is, to weaken Russia. You know, the, as the joke goes around on Twitter, you know, to fight Russia to the last Ukrainian. So my argument is that Britain and America are keeping the war going to some extent, in the sense, as we know, you know, Boris Johnson scuppers negotiations. Even recently, Rishi Sunak said to Zelensky, you know, we don't feel, now is not the time for peace. So I think there are a number of other agendas that are being pursued by Western states in this context, yep, in response to Russia's invasion. Because one thing that's really missing from any statements from Britain, America, France, you know, negotiations. Where are the negotiations? Where is there an attempt to stop this war, which, as we know, is having a massive impact on Ukraine, obviously. It sounds a silly thing to say.
Yeah. Well, I'm Alan Miller. I'm here talking to Dr. Tara McCormack. We're going to be with you just after this break. This is TNT Radio. Come back and join us just after this.
You should hear what Dirk Pohlmann is talking about.
You can see immediately what you're describing, because the doctors in our world have laboratory white coats, and that shows the distance that they have to the object of their science. That is not being as close as possible, not what you describe being in a communicative possibility, but rather with a white coat to show that there's an object and you're treated scientifically without feeling, really. And it's also that, in a way, that we pay doctors, we go to doctors and pay them when we're sick, whereas it would be more interesting to have it the Chinese style, where you pay as long as you're healthy, and the purpose is to keep you healthy. So, and that also, in a third part, reminds me of the way of communication, which was, in the COVID situation, became like warfare and became very totalitarian from the state side. This is what brought me, in the beginning, for me, it was a scientific topic, but I disliked very soon how everything constitutional was not constitutional, which means don't touch it, but became something like a fair weather story. If it starts to rain, it's not valid anymore.
The Dirk Pohlmann Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
To follow us on Twitter, click the link on our site.
You followed me. I feel all warm and fuzzy.
Or search on Twitter.
TNT Radio Live. TNT Radio.
Welcome back. I was just in the midst of it with Dr. Tara McCormack, and I'm wondering, we're talking about the situation, the analogies between what's going on in Ukraine and Russia and what happened in COVID in terms of the media, in terms of public discussion and debate. We've just seen that the BBC, a two-page spread on the BBC and the Telegraph today, with BBC journalists saying that they can't believe that at the time they tried to raise these issues, the editorial board around COVID and lockdown said, we don't want any scepticism. What is the antidote to this, in your opinion, Tara? Is it the public gets involved? How do you see it?
Yeah. And can I actually, one of the things that really struck me about COVID was that in a way, foreign policy, I know you, Alan, you were talking about Gulf War One, foreign policy has always been much more controlled. You know, in the British state, we have, I don't know what the contemporary term, there's a committee that all newspaper editors, that all media outlets sit on, that is run by the government.
Trusted News Initiative.
No. This is well before this. This is an official. It's called something like DSM. I'm sorry, my brain's gone blank. And everything that is deemed to be potentially a risk to national security, as defined by the government, of course, has to be passed by the government before it's reported. Yeah. Now, this is an old standing committee. So our new foreign policy news has always been quite tightly controlled in that sense. And of course, you've got some mavericks like Patrick Cockburn and so on. But basically, it's been, and Robert Fisk, it's always been pretty tightly controlled. And one thing that really struck me about COVID actually was it was the foreign policy model coming home to domestic control. Because previously, I think when it comes to domestic issues, there's always been potential, at least in some aspects, of more of a lively debate if one thinks about Brexit, for example. So what I thought really is we're seeing a real narrowing of all reporting there following that foreign policy model. So the first thing I would argue... Sorry.
Yeah, go on. Carry on.
So the first thing that I would argue, but this is the real problem, is that we need a public debate. We need to be talking about means, ends, consequences, but that requires the media to do its job. Now, it also requires our MPs to do their job. But unfortunately, as we saw with COVID, there is absolutely no one is willing to break the war consensus. I mean, there were a handful of Labour MPs, if you recall, last year, signed a really kind of milquetoast, wishy-washy letter. So, you know, it'd be quite a good thing to have negotiations. And Starmer, I can't remember, was it 16 MPs? Starmer jumped on them. Said,
right, well, what people will say on the negotiations, because I've, you know, in conversations I've had, people say, yeah, well, you can't negotiate with someone, it's that old adage, and they've got a gun to your head. And of course, people negotiate all the time. People negotiate with terrorists. Yeah. They always say they don't. People are always having back channels. They're always in geopolitical reality, in the hard, cold war, in the whole hard, cold face of war and counterinsurgency, all those things. People are doing these things all the time, right? That's the reality.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So, Michael, I want to read something just to you. I know it's that everyone can read, but I want to read this piece from The Telegraph because it was fascinating. So, because what it actually says in there today, and it talks about Esther McVeigh as well, talking about the concerns and everything. But, you know, I mean, Esther McVeigh makes the point, actually. I'll read her quote. I started at the BBC, and the whole thing is to get all sides of the argument and get new insights into the situation, be open-minded, not have a story written for you and fit the facts into that. And so she was saying that the lack of curiosity for the BBC was outstanding in terms of COVID. And then the examples of others that will say, like, for instance, Devi Sridhar, who said that the COVID jabs for children were 100% safe on Newsround, a TV program for kids here, and that the BBC would just repeat those things. Yeah. And I think what you're saying, there's a similarity. Now,
it's exactly the same, just to say it's exactly the same. You know, Ben Wallace will say we're sending long-range missiles to Russia, but this is not escalatory. And the BBC simply, in fact, The Telegraph has been terrible. The Telegraph, which was quite good in response to COVID, when it comes to foreign policy, The Telegraph has again completely shut down and reverted to type, again, with literally no one saying, well, I don't know, maybe it might be escalatory. The point is there's zero discussion in the media and in Parliament. And that is a real serious problem because COVID, as you know, well, you know my opinions on the lockdown and so on. But what we're doing here is engaging, as I said, in a proxy war with a nuclear state and the potential ultimately maybe for nuclear war. And it is absolutely incredible that there is no discussion about that.
Well, on this thing, is there, I mean, there's so much to talk about. I'd love to get you back again soon. And in a bit, we're going to have to swap over. But basically, I want to ask you now, I know you've said, well, you want to have the debate in the public. I mean, there are, firstly, is there any kind of initiative that you think that is challenging this and that's out there? I know there's people like the Stop the War Coalition. But the other thing is, are things worth fighting and dying for and worth going to war for, and even with a nuclear power? Because some people say this is cowardice, perhaps. I'm just going to fight devil's advocate.
Go on. I mean, I think that is a nice philosophical question. You know, my answer to that is, of course, there are things worth fighting for. But what we're not doing is discussing in the question related to the here and now. Is this worth fighting for? You know, do we want to go to war ultimately to defend Ukraine? I mean, I kind of think not, which is why, and there's, of course, there's a huge backstory to how, why we are where we are. But we know also that Ukraine wants to join NATO. And although there are constant pledges that Ukraine will join NATO, we know that in reality, behind the scenes, many NATO states, apart from Poland and the Baltic states, do not want Ukraine in NATO because of Article 5, the collective defense agreement. But it would be tantamount to signing up for a war. So in a way, what we have the West is doing to Ukraine is the worst of all worlds. We're kind of giving them enough weapons to keep fighting Russia to the last Ukrainian in order to weaken Russia. But ultimately, there will be negotiations, hopefully, if it doesn't become a wider war. There are some crazy things being suggested by the Polish government and some of the Baltic states about putting in their troops after the next NATO meeting, if there's no agreement on NATO membership for Ukraine. Again, that we should be discussing that. If Poland decides to send troops to Ukraine, of course, all NATO states have special forces in Ukraine, but actual troops. Well, what are we going to support Article 5? It's fine. If Poland wants to go to war with Russia, okay. But do we want that too?
So there's a lot more to talk about in the geopolitical landscape. I think a lack of interest is certainly not AJP Taylor's world that we're living in now. It does seem that there's a kind of chaotic, a sort of signalling, unhinged nature to all sorts of what was called diplomacy. Yeah. We've seen that in the run-up in terms of NATO. Listen, Dr. Tara McCormack, thank you so much for joining the show. If you're looking on the post, you can see how to follow Dr. Tara McCormack. We'll definitely get you back on the show again soon. We're now going to turn our attention to some things that have been happening in Scotland, in Edinburgh and Glasgow, as well as Aberdeen and Dundee. We've seen all sorts of articles, like, for instance, one-way cycle paths being sent into traffic. We're seeing local emission zones being tested out and imposed in different areas. We're seeing a discussion about low-traffic neighbourhoods, 15- and 20-minute neighbourhoods. But there are people that are challenging things, that are putting the Edinburgh City Council under pressure, that there are organisations around Leith and other areas. We've got Glaswegian companies like the guys in Birmingham, in King's Heath, who run companies and shops and hospitality, challenging the impact. Some are taking legal routes, some are organising. And very soon there's going to be an event there, which we're going to talk to our next guest about and some of the things that are happening, because I'm very pleased that we're now joined by Anne Roberts, who's in Edinburgh. How are you doing today, Anne?
I'm good. Thank you for the invite.
Fantastic. So, you've recently been involved in setting up a new initiative called Edinburgh Free Streets. Just tell us briefly what's going on in Edinburgh and in Scotland with some of these measures, please. Are they pretty much similar to what's going on in the rest of the United Kingdom that we've been seeing?
I think at one level, yes. But at another level, we're behind the curve in Edinburgh in comparison, say, with Oxford and Bath that you've been involved in. We're a capital city, and we have a topography or a geography that lends itself to neighbourhoods anyway. So there's quite a lot in place in Edinburgh that you could relax into in this scenario, but the rubber's hitting the road. So if Edinburgh Council is being very professional and slick in its communication, consultation may be more biased. And if you can imagine that they're running in parallel 20-minute neighbourhoods, low-traffic neighbourhoods and LES. So they're taking bite-sized chunks in parallel against all three, and that's tricky. And it's a juggernaut. that's what I feel is that the global, international, right to the city level, we are faced with competence and almost like management consultancy expertise driving this narrative. I'll kind of stop there and see if you want to come in.
Well, yeah, so I think it's really important. So, I mean, what we've certainly seen, and we've had guests on the show, and we've seen that in places like Oxford and Bath, there's all these different terms. So there's like active travel and livable streets. But we've seen that central government has funded many of these initiatives based on a kind of net zero approach. But actually now the UK, the British government, has pulled back from funding some of these initiatives because there's so much noise has been created by residents and businesses and by campaigners like yourself and us. And they've pulled away from some of that, from some of the funds. But at the same time, local authorities have grasped this in their teeth and they're generating a lot of revenue and they've shut off streets, roadblocks, and often not listened to anyone in the consultations. So what's the lay of the land there in terms of, do you think that the councillors and the council are going to be listening? How do you see that? What's your take on it?
So up till now, it's been very much about planning and one-way communication. But as of sort of March to May, low traffic neighbourhoods have become real. The residents are now experiencing the planters going up and they're becoming, some of the residents are seeing places for litter to congregate, to block pathways, and people are beginning to not be happy. For instance, in Kirstorfin, which is in the west of Edinburgh, there's a change.org protest going on that's had in excess of 1,300 signatures. There's a Facebook group with over 1,500 people. In another area, in 2021, when they announced this, they actually crowdfunded, the local West Edinburgh group crowdfunded a barrister and they got it blocked right at the beginning and it was put on pause. Then we've got Leith, which the residents are saying to me, we were almost a low traffic neighbourhood anyway. So actually, not a lot of protest is happening there, but they're watching what's happening and they're monitoring and evaluating. Then if I can go on to Les, our Les doesn't become live until the 1st of June 2024 in terms of fining and things. I want to say one thing. In Leith, what they're saying is it's about controlled parking, it's about travel restrictions, and it's about income generation. Many residents don't believe it's actually about their well-being. But they've had a beautiful new tram line brought down to Leith and it's fantastic. So there's good things happening too that are improving active travel. So you can't just say it's all doom and gloom, it's a balance.
Right. So I guess this is the key thing, right? Because on the one hand, you've got a situation where there's been a cavalier contempt. If you look at things like the ultra low emission zone or the clean air zone in the Midlands, you know, London City, Cannes, there's been ignoring of the public, ignoring of consultations, buying AMPR cameras beforehand, lying about deaths, treating the public with contempt. So it's definitely positive if there's a different approach by councils in Edinburgh and Glasgow. And if that is going to be the case, that's important. I think it's really fantastic that, you know, as you're saying, that lots of residents have challenged things. We did see that in Ealing and in Southwark, eventually in Southwark, some of the most recent low traffic neighbourhoods, I call them road closures, were overturned. And in Ealing, residents and businesses convinced them to stop it. And it's great that we've already seen preemptive action in Scotland. Tell us a bit, because I think the thing is this about public debate and where mobility is. I mean, everyone from, we've never really agreed to give up on mobility. There seems to be this permanent state of crisis and emergency that some are saying that we need to shut roads to do that and limit traffic with these ideas of you know, restrictions to what you can and can't do. But we know, together we very much like to get the public involved. I know you've got some plans afoot for an event and everything. Tell us a bit about that, if you would.
So a year ago, I got an invitation from Together to be a meetup host, which we've been meeting for a year now. And we're following your campaigns and doing Cash the Society and online safety. And then we're coming together on this particular event. And on the 12th of July, we're having a public debate and we're framing it under who benefits. It's like we can't argue that it's all bad, but there are certainly signals, particularly in Kirstorfen, where the actions of the council are creating mayhem, you know, congestion, and the residents are not happy, and they weren't happy in the west of Edinburgh. And there's 19 zones planned, and we're only at 3 at the early stages. So you can see there's a lot to come for Edinburgh, and we want to know what's happening a bit more and to debate it. We can see what's happening in Glasgow. Just today, the BBC published an article that says Glasgow City Council has 600 vehicles that are not compliant with the local emission zone. And yet they're not allowing a homeless charity to have an exemption because, in inverted commas, you've had 2 years to get ready. And how daft is that, in a sense, you know? So we're watching, and we're watching through what you're doing in England and Wales around the restrictions and the keeping people into the 20-minute neighbourhoods. You know, what is coming our way? So we're not complacent that it's all going to be fantastic. And certainly the consultations have been loaded, I would say, and influenced by interest groups. And the local citizen is only beginning to see it now when it actually becomes palpable for them, when they can't park their car, when they're having to buy a permit, and when there isn't enough room for parking. Just a final thing I'll say, and then I'll come back to you. We're labelling it who benefits. And I was talking to a Leith resident and said, well, walkers benefit. And he said, well, no, they don't. And that stopped me in my tracks. And he said, the pavements are so bad that it's not safe. And all the money has gone to the trams and the cycle lanes and what have you. So not even the traditional people that we think benefit necessarily do.
I mean, the thing that needs to be said is, thank you, Anne. I mean, in urban planning, it's always been the need of the whole of society and the community and to move around. That was partly the thing. We went away from the medieval idea of hamlets and being charged to go from one place to another, polled, and that we would have mobility and freedom of movement. We wouldn't have to explain ourselves. We could pursue our endeavours as long as we weren't doing something criminal. And it does seem that the limits and restrictions, the idea of surveillance, the idea of digital ID, ANPR cameras, yeah, the idea of passes, show me your papers, please, all these things, you know, some of the things that the C40 cities and others get excited about. And as you say, that some, like Sustrans and the cycling activists who have been very influential in local authorities and with the government and who have been campaigning and pushing hard for these things, they don't represent the whole of the community at all. And these questions about potholes, about when people have to walk, if they're disabled, if you've got family members, if you just want to do your shopping, they say these unnecessary journeys. Well, who is to decide what an unnecessary journey is? And then That's all in the context as well, isn't it, of, you know, these goals that are being set for 2030 and 2050. And I think the question is to have a really robust discussion. I think that, so, you know, one of the things we found in Bristol's coming up for an event soon as well. We found in Bath and in Oxford and in Haringey and elsewhere, there was a reluctance for most of the councillors. Some would come and debate with us to come and speak. But the whole idea now that together is that we're working with people in Scotland across the board, and that we, you know, we want to be quite strong and bold about this. We have a national campaign in the same way that Sustrans or the cyclists or Active Travel or Livable Streets or the Lib Dems and Labour or Conservatives are all a national organisation. There's local groups and people like yourselves that we've reached out to and we work with. And we're a national movement that tries to get the public engaged to hold our councillors and our MPs accountable, to actually get press, to get other friends and neighbours involved and engaged and do what they've done in some places and actually overturn these things and challenge them and stop them.
Yeah. And what I like about Together is it's like we have the UK umbrella of relationship. We know each other, you know, so we're getting intelligence from other areas arriving in our doorstep, which is alerting us to what's going on. And it's not political. It's about well-being. I remember you saying one time, it's not about right or left. It's about together. And I think, and for our meetups, we meet monthly. That's the thing that they like about our gatherings. And how can we speak to power? How can we argue into the space for balance, for all needs being met and not being downstream of a global agenda that doesn't seem sometimes to really recognize what reality is on the ground?
Yeah. And there's there's a very interesting piece today by Charles Moore in the Telegraph talking about net zero, just the reality of it really being very harmful and damaging, and that the Conservatives need to get a grip of it. But like, he talks about the Red Wall, he talks about a range of different groups of people that have come together as a kind of new coalition, effectively, people that were Labour and Conservative independents. We found that up and down the country, that's definitely true. People that have never been involved in politics, people that have in the Labour Party, that are very upset and furious about these things. We've just seen that the leader of the GMB has come out against these, what he calls these juvenile but damaging attacks on oil and gas that will harm ordinary working people. It seems that all round, and this is one of the reasons why we got a Together cabinet being launched, but we and you know that our campaigning on the ground with people like yourselves, Anne, and others in Glasgow and Aberdeen and Dundee, we need to be able to articulate these things across the board in areas and provide what used to be seen as both left and right always had a strategy for industrial policy, for growth, for productivity.
Right.
Now it seems it's all about limits and restrictions and suffocating things, not ambitious, you know.
Yeah. So
how do you think people are right now in terms of, you know, politically, what's the feeling? Do you get a sense of sort of post-COVID in terms of people's thoughts about just the ability to have an influence on things?
Oh gosh, I don't know fully. I think what I'm finding is I'm encountering people like me who haven't been engaged at the level we are now, that came out of COVID, you know, in the sense that we were caught on the hop by what happened and how easy it all seemed to be rolled out, and the acceptance. And I think the acceptance is not there to the same degree it was when it happened. I also think that people are seeing it really reaching them now in a way that maybe it didn't before, and that not necessarily is there a span of political options for us that are on our side. I mean, one of the things for me is I've always considered myself socially democrat. And then all of a sudden during COVID, my views became labelled right wing. And how could Nigel Farage be speaking for me? I used to laugh and say, you know, and not that I'm wanting to go there too much, but that's what's happening, is whatever was there before that we could ally our allegiances to has disappeared. And of course, we've got the Scottish SNP debacle at the moment that we're living with up here.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think the thing that's very exciting is this sense that people are once in a lifetime virus or threat. You can understand why people may have gone along with certain things, but this is now everyday life, livelihood, seeing family, freedom, autonomy, getting around, impacting us in the pockets. And also, whilst people recognize that those people flying around in jets and bulletproof cars, talking at big conferences, they aren't doing the same things as they're telling us all to do. And that surely, I think, and this is the important thing, is that what we need is a national plan that has the public at the heart of it, our needs, our interests, not to have power cuts, not to have limits, but to have infrastructure expanded and developed. One of the things we've got is people were listening in and they want to get involved around the country, anywhere in the UK. We have meeting groups, as Anne says. We have a toolkit for setting up events and activities for lobbying councillors and MPs. We're going to be inviting people, aren't we? Or you're going to be inviting councillors and MPs to this event. Is there any more you can tell us about the event? Do you know, is it keeping it a bit of a secret till the next few days and then releasing? Go on.
Well, we're just at the stage of the leaflet, and we've got the framing of the event with Together Central supporting us, of who benefits, you know, so that we can have a balanced conversation. What we don't want is to be this sort of arguing with each other and not hearing, we actually, and that's what we're about, is can we actually have conversations? And there's somewhere, you know, in the middle that's right for us all. And but sometimes there's a group that feel they're not being heard, and there's an agenda that says you're the bad guys, and there's something around the motorist at the moment is the bad guy. And what I want to do, and I think I've heard you say it as well, is if you want to reduce car travel, get the infrastructure right. Don't control and coerce. So what I like about Edinburgh is they've got the infrastructure on its way with the tram, and it really works. You know, but at the other level, stopping people from being able to park their cars or to find them or to make them, you know, pay more for the privilege of parking, is that really evocative? It doesn't feel it. It feels like it's closing down, and people get irritated and unhappy. And when you have roadworks and blocking off streets like in Kirstorfen, the people are up in arms. They're not happy.
Absolutely. So we've seen that Clint Pugh and many others on the Cowley Road in Oxford fought a very strong battle. They continue to. There's continuous events and challenging. He's had to close one of his businesses. We've had lots of videos from people. Videos are a really effective way of communicating. It's like during the vaccine mandate period for the NHS staff, or where we all managed to get involved and work together to challenge that. It tells the stories to the public, and we should definitely get some. I know you guys are talking to people in Edinburgh and Glasgow about that. One of these things is also hearts and minds. I think that people feel that there's not so much that they can do, but when they see people giving out leaflets, like in the streets, as you guys do, inviting people to a public debate, we have a membership scheme that together, we've just launched a business membership as well. So if you're in retail or hospitality, so we can do business with a directory, with people who are committed to similar principles. There's kind of a parallel organization, so we can kind of help fund one another, support one another, and actually make an impact, make a dent. So it's not all just a one-way street. And actually, when we see what we can do, we've had a big impact. We've already had an impact in a number of areas, and we want to grow that and make it bigger. So, I mean, just give us some, how can we find you? I posted them on my page, but just so we know, what's the Twitter handle? How do people find who you are on Twitter? Tell us a bit about that.
So I'm at Anne, capital A-N-N, Edinburgh. So that's my Twitter handle. We have an email address called togetheredinburgh@proton.me. And then, of course, you've got togetherdeclaration.org, because the nice thing about the event in July is you're supporting us and doing, you know, helping us make it happen. And again, that's one of the great things for people like us who are novices, to have that support and muscle behind us, but allowing us to be the local group. And that's one thing about Together I'd like people to know, is they don't wing in and take over. They're all about enabling us to really make what we're doing work. And that's what I really appreciate, helping with the brochure, helping us with getting the right venue, knowing what the technology needs to be. You know, I'm 71, you know, I'm having to try and learn all of these things at this time in my life, and it's great. And I've made friends with the meetup groups as well. That's the other thing. All of a sudden, it's not just about arguing into the space. It's about friendship and support for things that we think are important, that are not getting the level of attention we would like.
Yeah. Well, brilliant. Anne, I want to thank you for joining on the show today. I'm very much looking forward to, I should say that I'm going to be speaking in Edinburgh. I'm looking forward to it. I love Edinburgh. It's a fantastic city. I've been there many times. Yeah. Obviously, I've done a show at Edinburgh Festival a couple of times. I've been involved in speaking at panels at the festival. We're very pleased to be working with you and with people in Glasgow and across Scotland. So that's the 12th of July. Look out on the handle which Anne just gave you, and I'm going to repeat that. It's on my Twitter post as well, which is at Alan Vibe, and it's at Edinburgh Edin Free Streets, and Anne at Anne Edinburgh. And just in the last part of the show, I'm now going to just reflect on some of the things this week. And as we've been talking about the public and what the role should be in Edinburgh and Glasgow and elsewhere, and we've seen people standing up for some of the things, the level of contempt that we see that many of the technocrats have for us, for the public, this sense that even the relationship, the situation with Boris Johnson, and Boris Johnson, who obviously they knew that it wasn't as problematic as they said, they were able to work together. So why were they trying to terrify the pants out of everyone? That's absolutely an issue. But the whole way that he's been held accountable, he's not being held accountable. None of them have, for the measures of lockdowns, for the role that Matt Hancock has played, or indeed the so-called opposition who wanted longer and harder. And that all seems to have faded into the distance. We're now in this cost of lockdown, cost of living, inflation crisis. People are worried about interest rates, quite understandably. The housing market's being impacted. It's a limited area where people are investing in because we don't seem to want to invest in other things in Britain, infrastructure, tunnelling, transport, housing. We have a sclerotic lack of growth, a lack of productivity, a lack of wealth creation for all. And we have technocrats who tell us less is more, limits, restrict. It's almost like we're termites consuming too much and we have to get back in our box, get back into the house, get down, get locked away. Well, certainly at Together, we don't think that's acceptable. We are launching a cabinet, a shadow cabinet, with a range of areas, with experts in the fields linked to our campaigns, which will be pushing and driving the questions and issues like the Public Health Act, which, whilst people are right to talk about the World Health Organization and the amendments and the treaty, the Public Health Act was used in Britain to lock us all down before the WHO said anything like that. In fact, when he said it shouldn't do it. And that's why Sajid Javid at the time, when we were pressurizing him, said, don't worry, we will be sovereign, because he knew that we had a Public Health Act that was used to lock us down. That needs to be changed and amended. We're working with barristers Francis Hoare and lawyer Stephen Jackson with Law Fiction, all of them have been on the show around those issues and many others. And if you want to get involved campaigning for freedom, you should get involved with us. We're togetherdeclaration.org is our website, at togetherdec on Twitter and elsewhere and across all platforms. Do send a video in if you are furious about these measures in an area. If you're in business, you should get involved with our business membership, because this is about enabling us to have our voice. As the Conservative and the Labour and the Lib Dems go into stasis, collapse, tear themselves apart, I think in many ways it's a good time for opportunities for people. But there's also a sense that only around 20 to 30% voted in the local elections. People have to have a sense that we can have some control over our destiny and shape things. And that's the spirit in which Together is all about, how we can curate things, how we can innovate. And that takes us trusting one another and our abilities to do it, not just thinking it's all just predestined, we should have stayed locked up together, but that we can have an influence, we have agency, we can exert control, we can work with our fellow neighbours and friends and citizens to have an impact. We're not all mad, bad and dangerous. And we can have solidarity internationally with lots of nation states on that basis, but that we have control over things within our national sovereign borders. All these things are really important and essential. And the question of net zero goes to the heart of it, because as the discussion in schools and as the kind of impacts in our local authorities and roads up and down the country and limits and measures and restrictions are being posed, we need something that is going to be able to captivate and harness energy and our potential for the future. We need to have a great exhibition approach to our future, to investment, innovation, technology, science, and our humanity, in the spirit of the Enlightenment and the spirit of our desire and ability to be curatorial and to transform things. So we're very much looking forward to doing the event with the guys in Edinburgh on the 12th of July. We also have an announcement about Bristol coming out very soon. That's in addition to continuing our work with people in Oxford, in Cambridge, Cheyenne, who's been on the show, and all the guys there in Bath, where the Ring of Steel continues and the council still hasn't come out and met Save Our City people in Bath. In King's Heath, in Birmingham, and up and down the country, obviously in Haringey and Hackney and all the areas. You know, Hackney saying they're going to have 75% road closures. I don't think so, Philip Glanville. I don't think so, Mete Coban. I don't think Mike Hakata and Haringey, Mr. We're going to make it as painful as possible. You have any idea what's going to happen if you really try and implement these things? People are challenging. They're fighting back. We're not going to be in a permanent state of crisis. We are getting involved. We're getting engaged. A big shout out to everyone who's challenging today in Dartford, the ultra-low emission zone. Sadiq Khan, you need to move out of the way. This needs to get scrapped. We've got loads of people that are challenging it, cross-party. It's something that's inspired people. And we're all working together on these things. No matter the other issues we may not agree on, we might do. And we really need to work out ways that we could discuss more with people, don't agree on everything with, how we can kind of get the merit of one another's arguments and see the way through. And that's very much what Together's about, togetherdeclaration.org. And as we end this show, I just want to thank our guests today for being on here. You'll be able to hear the show again later. We're going to be posting it. I'm Alan Miller. I'll see you next week. Stay free. Remember, freedom of speech, freedom of expression. These are the paramount issues that we need to stand for together. I'll see you next week at TNT Radio. Thank you very much.